Welcome to In Conversation with Sheila Bender. Today you will hear a replay of a January 2019 interview with author Peter Donahue.
Hello, this is Sheila Bender, and you are listening to In Conversation, discussions on writing and the writing life. Today we have with us Peter Donahue. He's the author of novels Clara and Merritt and Madison House, winner of the 2005 Langham Prize for American Historical Fiction, and the short story collection The Cornelius Arms. He is co-editor of the 2016 edition of the memoir 7 Years on the Pacific Slope and the anthologies Reading Seattle and Reading Portland. His retrospective review column on Northwest literature has appeared in Columbia, the magazine of Northwest history, since 2005. He teaches at Wenatchee Valley College at OMAC and lives in Winthrop, Washington. His most recent novel is Three Sides, Water, Short Novels, and that's the one we're going to talk about today. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you, Sheila.
I'm excited to be talking to you because I have so much admired your book, Three Sides, Water, and can't wait to ask you questions about how you came up with that idea of writing short novels all situated on the Olympic Peninsula in one book. So Three Sides Water has three short novels. And first, I'd like to start by reading this description of your book that I came across online that I think is so well written and portrays what you've done in this book really well. And it says that in Three Sides Water, award-winning author Peter Donahue portrays the lives of three young people who seek meaning in an often violent, insensible world. Across the dramatic landscape of the Pacific Northwest Olympic Peninsula, Donahue's characters take extraordinary actions to transcend the limitations imposed upon them. And then it goes on to describe the three characters, which I'm sure you'll be describing too. And what happens is that each one of them deals in some way with their situation. And you cover quite a span of time on the Olympic Peninsula, right? The 1920s at Rialto Beach. Then we're in Fort Worden when it was a reform school in the 60s. That's Port Townsend. And then ultimately we're in Shelton in Seattle and much more recent. But what years were those?
That's set in 2015.
Okay. So I was thinking that we were getting close to now when I was reading that part. How did you get the idea to write this book?
I've always been fascinated by the Olympic Peninsula. When I lived in Seattle, I had a great downtown apartment that looked across the Sound to the mountains. Being a kid from New Jersey, I'd just stare at those mountains constantly. And I also read Ivan Doig's Winter Brothers very early in the 80s, and I was really influenced by that. But it wasn't until the 2000s, when I was living in Alabama, of all places, and I had an opportunity. I was teaching at a liberal arts college there, and they had this January term, a one-month term, and faculty could do pretty much anything they wanted, teach anything, travel with students. And so I brought students up to the Northwest to study the Northwest.
What a good idea.
Yeah, we spent a week on the Olympic Peninsula, staying mostly at the University of Washington Natural Resource Center in Forks as our base, but got around quite a bit. And it was during these trips that I really came to know the Olympic Peninsula very well. One of the things I do is have park rangers give students tours of all the three distinct bioregions of the peninsula, the alpine, coastal, and temperate rainforest. But it's where I got the ideas for these three novels. They all came to me about at the same time, and when I shared the ideas with a friend, he suggested I write separate novels. And marketing-wise, that was probably a good suggestion, but I just couldn't get away from the idea of, no, they were kind of conceived together, and I wanted to keep them together. I liked how they represented the peninsula across both history and geography. And those two things, I think, really intersect in defining who we are. And I also latched on to the conceit of the short novel or novella as a kind of literary peninsula. Neither island nor mainland, short story or novel. but kind of both attached and separate. I really latched on to this idea of the work as this trilogy or triptych.
I love hearing that you used the metaphor of the peninsula for the structure of the novel. I know you're prepared to read a little bit from each novel, and I'd love to hear that now.
Sure. I'll just start with the first one, On Rialto Beach, which is set in 1925. The narrator is a young woman, 21, whose name is Marguerite, and she's one half of the Nartel twins. And I think that's all you need to know. And they're out on Rialto Beach. When we intuit the domain that lies beyond the capacity of our dim senses, it's like a glimpse of unexpected light in the dark, there then gone. And while I don't pretend to be an occultist or spiritualist, mystic or clairvoyant, I believe the world is brimming with phenomena both seen and unseen. Whether Mr. Claude Alexander Conlin, the man who brought us to Rialto Beach that summer and who hired the brute who attacked me, ever subscribed to such fancies, I could not say definitively. He did, however, exploit those fancies in others. In the years that Marie and I spent as his stage assistants, 1920 to 1926, he claimed to be the world's greatest mentalist, billing himself variously as the man who knows, the crystal seer, the telepathic one, he who foresees, and Alexander the Great. Privately, he acknowledged his feats of psychic fluency were predicated on mechanical deceit and the unflagging gullibility of the public, and little else, he would add. Yet it was this little else, this undefinable element, that always left me wondering. Indeed, he liked to keep me and Marie guessing, as when he foretold that our mother would remarry and 1 month later she did. "She told you," we protested. "Ridiculous," he replied. "Your mother would never entrust such knowledge to me. And besides," here he lowered his chin to peer at us with his Swami's gaze, "you should know better than to doubt the mystic undercurrents that swirl beneath the world's sham appearances." It was true that our mother tended to be a secretive person, unlikely to divulge such details from her private life to Mr. C or anyone else. It was also true that even after handing us over at the tender age of 17 to the care of Mr. C and his wife, Lillian, for the purpose of advancing our stage careers, our mother was never particularly fond of him. It wasn't that she suspected his motives, but more that she always had been wary of people in general, especially men. As for the mystic undercurrents, Marie scoffed at such pompous talk. I, on the other hand, preferred to keep an open mind. Regrettably, no notions of either this world nor its nether corollaries, as alluring as these may be, can adequately account for what happened that particular summer. Lou Morton was new to Mr. C's road crew. Charlie, who had been Mr. C's road manager for 8 years, recommended him, saying he knew Lou's brother in Los Angeles, and so Mr. C hired him. But he had only been with the crew 3 weeks before this latest trip to Rialto Beach, the spot at the mouth of the Quialt River where Mr. C had built his summer compound.
I was talking with some people here at the station, and I said mm-hmm. that this first bit of your book takes place at Rialto Beach, where this L.A. entertainer, kind of pseudo-psychic guy, has built himself a very large house. And that I found it really interesting to learn about that and what it took to be able to do that in those years. And they said, oh, that's not possible. That couldn't have been done. And I'm thinking, but I believe this book. I believe Peter's research. And you have this background in historical fiction. So what about that? Was it possible to develop a compound?
Oh, yeah. So when I took students out there to meet a park ranger, we're gathering in the parking lot. And the park ranger just casually pointed up to the woods from the parking lot just above the beach and mentioned how in the 1920s there was a mentalist magician who had a compound up there in the woods. And, of course, this just caught my imagination. And so the next time I was there, I walked up into those woods, and you can even see the foundation through all the buildings there. Mm-hmm. Just between the parking lot when you go down to the beach, the woods right there. And so, yeah, he's a real figure, Claude Alexander Conlin.
He is?
He is a real figure.
Is he the person who built the house that you saw the foundation of?
Yes, he built a compound. It was a house.
Okay.
And so several outbuildings, a couple tree forts, and he'd bring his whole entourage up there from L.A. for the summer because he loved to hunt and fish, and he loved the Northwest. He eventually bought a house in Seattle. And in fact, the man who owns the magic shop in Pike Place Market, Daryl Beckman, is kind of an expert on him and put together a kind of scrapbook about him that includes a lot of photographs and such and some commentary about him that you can buy at the magic shop.
Well, thank you for that. Yeah. So obviously you do a lot of research in order to make the stories historically based. And I wanted to ask you, too, if the Iron Man of the Ho, who makes an entrance as a visitor, is that something that you learned about?
I don't know too much about the Iron Man of Ho. He was around it during that period. And so I couldn't resist having him make a cameo.
Oh, good. Well, I don't know if everybody...
Whether he ever met him, I don't know.
I don't know how many people listening know the story of the Iron Man of the Ho. The way I heard it is that he lived as a recluse out there on the peninsula in the heavily wooded area on the Ho River, and that he needed a stove, and he carried a very heavy iron stove all the way from where to his house. I don't remember the place, do you remember where he got the stove?
Yes, and the legend goes that someone said, "Isn't that stove heavy?" And he said, "Oh, it's not so bad. It's the bags of flour inside
of it that make it heavy." Right. Oh, I'm glad he made a cameo. It made me smile. All right, let's hear a little bit from the next part.
The next one is at Fort Worden, which is set at the fort, as you said, during the period when it was a juvenile delinquent center, which very few people know about. Again, when I was bringing students around the peninsula, I came across this plaque in the corner of the fort that explained how it was a juvenile delinquent center from 1955 to 71, and that became the basis for this novel. And I think I'll read just the opening section here. After 3 days of interviews, diagnostic tests, and around-the-clock observation, the assessment committee told me I suffered from an, quote, inadequate personality. When asked what that meant, the committee members all looked to the state-appointed psychologist on the committee, Dr. Vernon O. Reinhold, who cleared his throat and leaned across the conference room table toward me. Avery, he said, the assessment of inadequate personality signals a lack of psychological maturity appropriate to age. He explained that, in my case, it included indications of prolonged unsociability, occurrences of acute irritability, chronic impulsiveness, episodes of aggressive and or reckless behavior, difficulty adhering to accepted social norms, unrealistic life goals, and general overexcitability, aka nervous disquiet. He added that since my arrival at the Fort Worden Diagnostic and Treatment Center for Juvenile Delinquency on the day of, and here he glanced at his file, Monday, June 15th, 1970, most of the aforementioned symptoms had been observed in me. He noted that these same symptoms had, in all likelihood, been the lead contributory factors to the trouble I'd gotten into over the past several months. I had to admit, it sounded pretty bad, but the only part of his explanation I truly understood was the getting into trouble part. The rest was just mumbo-jumbo. I'm sure my offenses were all well documented in the manila folder beneath Dr. Reinhold's clasped pale hands. The running away from home, the shoplifting from the grocery store, the breaking and entering into a neighbor's cabin, the vandalism of the high school, the instances of drunkenness and drug use, mostly weed, some hashish, speed a few times. All these incidents were made worse, of course, by my blatant disrespect for authority, or more precisely, for the Spanaway Police Department. Or more precisely still, for Officer Leroy Yarnell, who overstepped the line when he confiscated my hash pipe, which, according to the guy who sold it to me, was made of Frisian marble from Turkey, and then threw it into Spanaway Lake. I was so pissed off at Officer Leroy that I shoved him against his Crown Vic cruiser and bolted across the park. He then ran after me, stepped on a rock, broke his ankle. All this resulted in me being slapped with a Category 2 offense that landed me in juvie in historic Port Townsend on the beautiful Olympic Peninsula.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. In case you just joined us, you are listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, discussions on writing and the writing life. Sheila is talking with Washington novelist Peter Donahue about his new book, Three Sides Water, short novels, each about a young person finding their way during different decades and communities around the Olympic Peninsula.
After I hear you read from the section about the young boy who's in the reform school at Port Townsend's Fort Worden, I realize how much research you must have done into psychology as well as into what was happening at the reform school. So can you tell us more about what you found out?
It was the period of behavioralist or developmental psychology with such figures as Erik Erikson and B.F. Skinner. That's who this Dr. Reinholdt is based on. There was a doctor like that at the center who pretty much prescribed how the center would be run. And in fact, the old guardhouse at the center, which is now Brewpub, was where students were put in the hole, as it was called, for isolation. And I also learned a lot. I had the benefit of an oral history that the Friends of Fort Worden had done. And this was an oral history of faculty and staff who had worked at the Juvenile Delinquent Center. I got a lot of stories from there, such as the time the Black Panthers came to the fort, and that makes it into my novel. But the one problem about the oral histories was that it didn't include any of the residents, as they called the detainees there, because their names are all sealed and they couldn't access them. So one of the reasons I wanted to write this story is to get that point of view.
Did you find some people to talk to, or you just realized what it might be?
Actually, once when I was visiting the guardhouse, when it was still the information center, I did actually meet a man who had been a resident there and talk to him a little bit. But to be honest with you, some of it, quite a bit of the main characters is based on my own growing up in the 70s. I never got sent to juvie, but I did a lot of the things that he got sent to juvie
I
for.
See.
I just never got caught.
Yeah.
I was fairly wayward and didn't have really any parental oversight.
So this man that you met who had been a resident, was that just happenstance? You just happened to be there?
It was total happenstance.
How lucky. Yeah. Well, I don't want to run out of time to have you read from the third short novel, so let's do that.
Okay, this is Out of Shelton. It's set in 2015, and it involves a man who works at the family mill in Shelton who becomes a Bing Crosby tribute singer because of the influence of his grandmother who raised him. So I'll just pick it up a few pages in. When I think of what it must have been like in Shelton in the 1930s and 1940s when my grandmother was young, I can imagine how she must have felt when she first heard Bing Crosby sing. At the start of the 20th century, the town had a dozen mills dominated, then as now, by Simpson Timber. The town was the heart of the sawdust empire. The stands of fir, hemlock, cedar, and spruce were still abundant. The national economy was healthy in the decade following the First World War, and the mills operated around the clock, coating every surface within a 10-mile radius with coal soot and sawdust. Company shacks lined the tide flats, while farther up the hill, company managers and owners built their large houses and sent their children off to college in California. When the Great Depression hit, nearly all the mills closed, which in some ways was just as well, since by then all the surrounding hills had been stripped of their timber and were nothing more than what Granddad called stump branches. So when my grandmother tuned into the radio station out of Seattle and heard Bing singing, what dreamy wonder his deep melodious voice must have cast over her glum soul in that damp claustrophobic corner of the Olympic Peninsula. Add to this having to see her husband, my grandfather, go off to war a year after they'd been married. She became pregnant with my Uncle Lilas during my grandfather's only leave before shipping off for the Pacific. So it's easy to see how Bing became such a great source of solace for her. She probably felt he was singing just for her, just as millions of young women across America felt. And whenever a Bing Crosby movie happened to come to the only movie house in town, she probably felt as if he'd come all the way to Shelton just to serenade her. So when people my age and younger complain about what a drab place Shelton is to live in and make plans to move to Seattle or Portland or San Francisco, they have no idea how good they have it. When I was born in the Mason County General Hospital, The town was still in the dumps from the downturn in the economy in the 70s, but it was nothing compared to my grandmother's day. By the time I was growing up in Shelton, the air was clean. The clear-cut tracks had long ago been reforested, and even the oyster beds in Oak Bay were making a comeback after being decimated by decades of discharge from the old pulp mill. Lindsay always said she liked Shelton, and unlike many people we knew, she never felt the need to escape and live elsewhere. I like Shelton, too, and still do. It was where we both grew up, where we both had family, the town we knew better than any other, the place that, unequivocally, one of Lindsay's words, felt like home.
Thank you. You know, Lindsay is the woman that he is with, and they've both, at this point, escaped to, to use that word, to Seattle. What a beautiful description of place. I'd really love to hear you talk about how you created place as a character. I read about it in a lot of writing craft books. It's a big deal to make character part of the scene in a larger way than just the scene. And I wonder if you have anything to say about that in particular. I know that having read all three and just hearing you again today, I feel like I remember and know the Olympic Peninsula better through not only the landscape, but the national and local things that happen around here. And so anything you could add to that would be so wonderful to hear.
Well, for me, the landscape and history are key. Those two intersect very much, as I said earlier, in for me, in the formation of character. Basically, people, as I see it, are defined by place and period. And so those are foremost concerns when I'm representing a place and representing characters in a particular place. After that, it is the particularities of the place and the period that do really concern me. That comes down to the research of what everyday life was like in that place at that time.
How did you do that? How do you do research on everyday life?
Archival research. I spent a good amount of time in the Jefferson County Historical Society archives. They're out on the highway looking at a lot of old newspapers so that when I say a certain movie was playing at the drive-in on a certain date, it was. But also just going to the place. Site visits are real important to me. So I spent a lot of time on the peninsula once I started working on this book and just got very familiar with the terrain and with the towns and the buildings in the town, especially Shelton. But I also read a lot. I read a lot of nonfiction. There are some great popular histories about the Olympic Peninsula. But I also, to get a sense of the lived experience of the place, both in the past and now, I turned to fiction. And there are a lot of really fabulous novels set on the Olympic Peninsula, like David Gooderson's and Jonathan Evanson's, and Scott Elliott's Temple Grove is a favorite of mine. I'm really taken by some of the older works, really superb novels by writers who are largely forgotten, like Archie Binns or Patricia Campbell is a real favorite of mine, who wrote four or five novels set on the Olympic Peninsula, like right there in Port Townsend, or there's another one in Chimicum Valley, another one in Port Ludlow, that really get at the landscape and the history of the place.
How did you find those? How can we find those?
Public libraries probably have them. I found them through research. Part of my column for Columbia Magazine has been reviewing these old out-of-print novels from early 20th century.
Are there back issues of that available that we can kind of catch up with you?
Yes, there are. And if you allow me, I'll make a plug that next year, next fall, I'll have a collection of those essays coming out with Washington State University Press.
Wonderful plug. So, and what will it be called then?
It's going to be called Salmon Eaters, Apple Knockers, Rain Worshippers, and Sage Brushers, Washington's Lost Literary Legacy.
Fabulous. I love long titles, and that says it all. When did you say it would be out?
It's going to be out October 2019.
All right. That's not too long, the way time flies.
No.
Thank you. That's a great plug. Good to know that. I want to talk to you about so many more things, and we only have a couple of minutes. So do you have things that you'd like to add to what you said so far?
I have to say, when we were talking earlier, you asked in one of your questions about, you know, how this work differs from other works I've done For me, it's a much more personal work than my other works, and that might be because it's the first time I've done extended first-person narration. And so I really delved into character and my character's psyche, I think, more than I ever have before.
It shows that each character is so interesting. It's interesting to me that of the three, one is a woman, and I think that it might be a challenge for a man to write about a woman. She's convincing. And I guess I'm imagining whether she was real, too, from the life of the entertainer who came up here and built the compound.
There were the two twins, yes.
Okay. Well, I really think you pulled it off. I just admire this book so very much, and I'm very much looking forward to your very long-titled collection of your columns.
Thank you.
And do you have a next project you're working on?
Well, I'm kind of plucking away at a novel set over here in Okanagan County. I think it's a ways off, though, because I still have a lot to learn about this big county over here.
Mm-hmm. So you're doing that. You're in the midst of that now.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Well, Peter Donahue, this has been wonderful. I really appreciate your time. Is there any way that people can find you on the web to learn more?
Yes, they can go to my website at peterdonahue.org.
And let's spell Donahue. It's for people. Mm-hmm. It's D-O-N-A-H-U-E, peterdonahue.org.
Right.
Okay.
And they can find out more about my books there. And there's also contact info there.
Great. Thank you so much. We'll look forward to your next trip over to Jefferson County.
I look forward to that as well.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman.